from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. During the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, philosopher and San Francisco State professor Jacob Needleman had an epiphany. Rather than fear, he experienced, quote, a profound sense of wonder that such a movement as this could, in one moment, take away everything in my life, end of quote. Needleman describes this metaphysical event in his new book, An Unknown World, which explores the nature and meaning of the earth and humans' relationship to it. Jacob Needleman joins us for the hour ahead. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. San Francisco State Professor of Philosophy Jacob Needleman joins us in studio for this forum hour. Former director of the Center for the Study of New Religions at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union, he's also served as research associate of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, as a research fellow at Union Theological Seminary, as adjunct professor of medical ethics at University of California Medical School, and as guest professor of religious studies at the Sorbonne in Paris. He's the author of many books, most notably The New Religions, which was a pioneering study of new American spirituality, The Wisdom of Love, Money and the Meaning of Life, The Heart of Philosophy, The American Soul, Why Can't We Be Good, and The Essential Marcus Aurelius. And he's also general editor of the Penguin Metaphysical Library, and has been general editor of the Element book series, The Spirit of Philosophy. He's featured, as some of you may recall, in Bill Moyer's PBS series, A World of Ideas. And we're here to talk this hour, well, about philosophy, about theology, religion, but mostly about his most recent book, which is called An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth. Welcome back to Forum, Jacob Needleman. Good to have you.
So good to be with you again, Michael.
The Earth is a sacred book. That's kind of the key in many ways,
yes,
to this.
Yes, it is.
Tell us what that means.
The Earth is a sacred book. That means that I started my life as scientific, as a kind of an atheist, as a young man. And after teaching about religion, which I did with some reluctance, I got to understand that I'd been taking the Bible literally, and that's why I revolted against it in a way. I couldn't accept it. And then I realized after I started teaching about religion that the Bible, scripture, in East and West, has depths of meaning I never could feel before. The symbolic, the analogical, the anagogical, the story element in it, the art element in it, the sequence of feeling and thought and imagery. And it was deep, deep meanings, and I began to realize that this is extraordinarily sophisticated and full of meaning and upon meaning that I never understood before when I was younger. And then I realized my love of nature was still always there. My love of science was always there. But when I started, I felt I needed to try to write about the Earth, because I began to realize that science, I loved science, but I was very resistant to what is called scientism, that looking at everything in nature and having a kind of a dogmatic, almost fundamentalist view that there's no purpose, no meaning, no divinity in the universe. And I realized that they were looking, the scientists, even when they're very brilliant, were looking at nature in a way that fundamentalists look at the scripture. They were taking it literally, in a sense. That is to say, they're looking at it mainly with one part of the mind, the head, the illogical mind, and not with the knowledge that can come from the heart, from the feeling. Because when those two go together, knowledge of the head and the feeling, you get a whole different picture. And nature, the earth itself, was like a sacred book, which is actually an ancient idea, which used to be expressed as nature as the signature of God, as the language of God. And I realized I came with like a tremendous revelation, a shock to me, that the earth itself is full of meaning. It's like a sacred book, and when you look at it with the heart as well as the mind, you begin to see it, its livingness, its purposiveness, its cosmic intelligence, if you like, without being all fundamentalistic and about creationism or anything of that kind. So that's what the book really is trying to expose, that to look at the earth as one would look at great sacred texts as a way.
So, it's also, the sacredness also has to be seen in line with one of the central experiences that you write about, which was the Loma Prieta earthquake, and realizing just how vulnerable we are and how some shakes can literally change our lives if the earth happens to go in that geological direction. But it took you in a metaphysical direction.
It took me in a metaphysical direction when I realized what we're living on. One little twitch of this being called Earth, and everything is different. Everything, one's mortality is revealed. The meaning, the reality that one perceives is shown to be something quite different, quite tenuous as well as quite wondrous, quite awesome. So, yes, the earthquake was like I think for all of us when we saw that, we had that earthquake in 89?
Yeah, in fact, you write about how it seemed to change everybody around you, not only you internally and the attention you gave to the earth and attention you gave to the earth as a kind of living being, but also everybody seemed not so wrapped up in themselves, more connected.
That was the amazing thing, that it was as though the whole city of San Francisco was in a state of deep self-awareness. The whole city seemed to become ethical and moral and open, and it had fallen away from all the attachments. In other words, it seemed like almost the whole city of San Francisco was for a day or two freed of its egoism. That was a stunning thing to walk out and people opening doors for you, people quietly smiling at you, people being courteous.
You're right here. And speaking to people, especially in extended conversation, I soon realized that they, and I myself, hardly ever interrupted. People just listened. I felt it. And they must have felt it, too. There was no tense waiting for an opening in order to have one say or refute the other or outshine him or get something off one's chest. In addition, people waited in long lines without nervousness. Doors were open for others, and not only men opening doors for women. People passed each other on the street feeling free to smile or say hello or say nothing at all. I wonder if listeners are really can relate to this, if it resonates for them.
If they were in the earthquake, I bet it does resonate with them, because we did become more like the people we would wish to be.
And in a sense, you were talking before about, well, you've done this Gurdjieff work for many years now, and there's a cosmic consciousness that's linked to this more greater attention to the earth. I think about Ouspensky and Gurdjieff, but I also think about Whitman. You know, the idea that if you're more aware of the earth, you're more aware as an earth being of the cosmic sense of your identity.
Absolutely. And the cosmic dimension from the most ancient teachings that the earth itself and the universe itself is a living being, is organic, has full of purposes and layers of meaning and purpose, our cosmic environment. And that influences our sense of what we are, too. Who are we? If we look at ourselves as being in a universe just of blind mechanical processes with no direction, no purpose, no intelligence, no love even, then it's hard to see ourselves as anything more than a blind, purposeless being.
I was reading an interview that you did with a fellow by the name of Crum, you were talking about a rocket launch as a spiritual event, just the awe and wonder and amazement at it. And then that famous photograph of the blue marble. I mean, these things come into play in a sense, directing us toward something more nominal, as Kant would call it, something
noumenal. Yes,
noumenal,
yeah. Yes, absolutely. Don't you, we all remember when we first saw that photograph of the whole earth, it was so wondrous. Why? What was it? It made us aware that this was life. This was a living thing. We were part of a living thing. It really brought us to see the earth as something we had to care for, something both tender and immense at the same time. And that was a wonderful. Now, the rocket launch, Apollo 17, was amazing, because that was Time magazine brought me down there to be an observer. Everybody was full of thousands of newspaper and radio reporters. Everybody was cynical. A lot of people were cynical about the space program. We were all sitting out in the big lawn drinking beer and laughing and all the rest of it. And then suddenly this thing 35 stories high across the lagoon with big white lights on it, suddenly flames start billowing from out of it. It's beautiful color. The sound comes over the lagoon with a deep, deep sound that everybody's jaw started dropping. And people, oh, my God. And it started rising slowly up into the air. And you could hear jaws dropping and people suddenly quiet.
Even atheists saying, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, they said. In other words, I can't repeat on the air, but they were saying, this is incredible. And as it rose, it was that sense of wonder. Now, the sense of wonder is a lot of what this book is rooted in, what that means. A sense of wonder. Nobody, everybody was like that. We talked about the earthquake. Everybody, even the cynical reporters, were touched down deep in that part of us that has wonder. And I came to this thing that nobody would ever, can ever commit a crime in the state of wonder. They were deeply moral people, at least until they got back into the hotel.
Talking with Jacob Needleman. His new book is An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth. He's the author of The American Soul and many books, and professor of philosophy at San Francisco State. This sense of wonder, and it ties in with your view of spirituality, and I'm thinking about your last book, which we discussed, where you talk about inner empiricism as opposed to external empiricism, that you go inside to feel these kinds of emotions and to connect with something more transcendent, more powerful, more beyond our ken, all that.
Yeah.
But we could just be this lonely, isolated blue marble, you know, floating in space with other planets. I mean, why all the attention to the Earth? I mean, because we're so small in the cosmic sense, so tiny and infinitesimal.
Yes, quantitatively, we are nothing practically, a speck of a speck. But qualitatively is another matter. And by we measure ourselves by our quantitative size, yeah, we're nothing. But qualitative in terms of our level of experience and our level of consciousness, our level of understanding, that puts us in a whole different measure, a whole different scale. Quantitatively, we're nothing. Qualitatively, we can touch something very high, very great. Science is not very good at measuring the quality in that sense. That's not what it does well. So to find out quality, value in the universe, one has to touch something deeper in oneself as an instrument of perception. And that tells us that we're not just, we're both everything and nothing at the same time.
And it's really the everything that you get at here in a poignant way, because what happens in this book of yours, this new book of yours, is suddenly you're taken with some books out of your past and your childhood, which is actually very moving to me. You discover these books that first ignited your interest in science, and it's very exciting for you to sort of go back to them. But also you're having dreams about a young Armenian friend of yours who you used to have very deep, profound discussions with during your boyhood, and he's coming to you every night in your dreams, which is pretty strange in itself.
These were visions that came completely uncalled for, unanticipated. And I took them and wrote about them in a way that I hope will communicate this what we're speaking about, the values that can come by coming deeper into yourself and not depending just on sense perception and logic.
Because you go deeper into yourself, there's a danger of solipsism. There's a danger that you can, you know, find just an abyss or maybe totally contradictory meanings, no?
Yes, you can. Therefore, you need to have some kind of knowledge guiding you, some kind of ideas that are not just your own creation. So there's a danger of becoming fantasy and imagination and even neurosis. But if it's done in a controlled way, in a guided way, with knowledge that of thousands of years people have gone inside to find ideas and truth and perception, and that then you can know things about the universe that you can't know just by looking outside yourself.
And that has to do with finding purpose for the Earth, ultimately?
Certainly it does. Because, look, even taking from the point of view of ecology, we all know now, we accept that everything in nature has a function, has a purpose. It's not there It doesn't. It does something. It's part of a whole, a living whole. And the question, what is the purpose of the human being, is necessary to answer that. You have to know what a human being is. And to know what a human being is, you have to go inside yourself and look and study. Then comes the next big question. In that case, what of the earth itself? Is it just happened to be there for no reason at all? Does it not have also a function in the entire cosmic ecosystem? And that was what I'm trying to show in this book.
You make an analogy between the earth and our body, in fact.
Yes.
And one could say that perhaps the earth is decaying and getting old and all that, like our body. And if it's mortality that we're talking about with the earth, you know, possible planetary extinction, get hit by a comet, or to bring all this in, but one has to think about just the earth in terms of, again, a cosmic realm, or if one does, one sees just how vulnerable the earth is again, just like you did with the earthquake.
I think that's true. And the earth, you have to ask ourselves, what does the earth really need from us, from human beings? And if we look at the concept, if we look at purpose from the understanding of teleology and purpose, it just makes no sense to say that if the earth needs something from us or we wouldn't have appeared. It's just like it needed plants, it needed animals. They're all serving some purpose, some function, even biologically. And in that sense that human beings are here, can't be that we're just here to clean up the mess we ourselves created. It's got to be something else. And what I'm trying to show in this book is that the earth, like Rilke said in one of his great poems, the earth needs us to be conscious of it. It needs our consciousness. You might say, well, that's sign of what is consciousness and all that. But that's what distinguishes us from the animals. This, a certain kind of consciousness is what we're capable of if we really work for it. And maybe that's what the earth needs from us, not just to take care of them, of the pollution, which God knows is necessary.
But if we respect the earth and if we have consciousness of the earth, it would make us stewards even more and speak to the ecological necessity of our being
absolutely
conservationists and environmentalists.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only would we be able to do the right things, we would be able to be the right people that the earth needs.
And isn't our body our own private personal earth? It is so, isn't it? If the body can come alive, transform its state, serve my deeper aims, heal itself when flooded with conscious attention, if the body can do, act, love with entirely new force and joy when it is filled with conscious attention, then we may say the earth itself will be a new earth when human beings see her, hear her, taste her with the conscious attention that only human beings can
exactly
bring to her.
Yep.
And it's always she. I mean, Mother Earth and all that. You even at one point early talk about some of the early myths, the sun being, you know, Apollo and the male, and Earth, the moon being the female with cycles and all that. But it's Mother Earth.
Mother. I think it's a mother myself. That's my – but it's often referred to as Mother Earth, yes. And Father Sun as the progenitor, as the life giver,
The genesis of life. So we respect the matrix of that, the maternality of that.
I think so. I think it. Our bodies, in any case, belong to the earth, but something else can appear in us from another level. Call it the sun, the stars, what the ancients called that. That is not just of the earth, but of another quality. So we're really like the ancient Chinese and other great teachings have said. The human being is between us, both heaven and earth in us. And our work as a human being is to find the balance between those two.
What about the unity? I mean, that comes into play in a central way as well. I'm thinking about the fact that, I mean, all the spiritual study that you've done and all the extraordinary work you've done in different faiths and different traditions and myths, would human beings aspire more to be at one with the earth, and to feel that oneness or closeness with the earth, or with each other, or perhaps beyond the earth, with the cosmos, with something even higher and more indecipherable to us or inscrutable to us?
Well, the more we come in touch with the higher within ourselves, the more we are able to love our neighbor and care for the earth. I think that goes that way. That whatever that higher is, whatever we call it, higher energy, higher consciousness, or divine or whatever you call it, when it does enter our life, our body, it enables us to be the person that we would wish to be, but what we were meant to be. And if it doesn't result in love and compassion for one's neighbor, then it's not the higher energy.
Well, if I'm being a naysayer or a devil's advocate, so be it. But, you know, we have these kind of colloquies in philosophy, you and I, through the years. And, you know, you say, some of the neighbors are not worth loving. I mean, let's begin with that premise.
Sure.
But also the idea that the earth is not necessarily always a friendly place for us to love. Not only earthquakes, but volcanoes, tsunamis. I mean, the earth can do dreadful things to civilizations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hurricanes.
It's bigger by far than we are in that sense. So what would it mean to really have a question of what is nature? What is our relationship to nature with all its forces and all its dangers and all its vastness? And what you're speaking of is evidence that the earth exists and nature exists at a scale of vastness far greater than our everyday concerns and so forth. And that has to be part of our understanding. And I think, how can we talk about it? Love in a deeper sense can't be simply based on everything being nice.
Nicely said. Let me open the phone lines and actually invite those of you listening to join this conversation we're having with philosopher and author Jacob Needleman. His newest book is An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth. And we do welcome your calls, so feel free to join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, 866-733-6786. You might want to talk about what you see as your relationship to the earth, or how when the earth abides and at least according to the Old Testament, and how it abides for you. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can post questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate with us, and we do want to hear from you. Let's go to Corey as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I really, really appreciate hearing your voice in this, that you've come from a scientific and even atheist background, and that you've come to this, you know, place of looking at the universe as, you know, with sanctity, like seeing the sanctity in life. It's something, I made a very similar journey. I have a bachelor's in history of religions. I was raised Unitarian by a lot of scientists, but I came out of that, you know, appreciating lots of other religions, but hating Christianity. And then I met some Christians who were very intelligent and thoughtful and living the teachings of Jesus rather than sort of in this fundamental literalist way that you were talking about. Like Quakers, for example, very good at that, reading John Woolman. I've been really upset about this backlash against religion that's almost militaristic. Like Dawkins refers to himself as a militant atheist, and this sort of this attacking religions as horrible as the cause of all evils in the world. You know, people do their political, you know, greedy things no matter what for. You know, religion has been one of the things that people do it under. Nationalism is another. But I think it's causing this reaction against religion that throws out the baby with the bathwater.
Corey, you raised some important points. We're coming up on a break. Maybe when we come back, before we go to more calls, we'll talk about science and religion and how they may be, and in many people's eyes, Richard Dawkins, he's a religious guy. He believes in Darwin. This is religion. But we'll come back to this whole question of science and religion and how the two may be compatible or incompatible. But feel free to join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're spending the hour with Jacob Needleman, author of An Unknown World, his newest book, during the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Philosopher and San Francisco State professor Jacob Needleman had an epiphany, and rather than fear, he experienced, and I'm quoting now from his book, a profound sense of wonder that such a movement as this could in one moment take away everything in my life, end of quote. And he describes this as a metaphysical event in his new book, An Unknown World, which explores the nature and meaning of the earth and human relationship to it. So that's really what our subject is this hour to a great extent. We were, before we went to the break, talking about religion or faith and science. And there is a new atheism, not even so new now. It's been around for a while. You know, I've interviewed all of those so-called new atheists. I call them the trinity of new atheists, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and Christopher Hitchens. And the last caller brought up, you know, the sense of the incompatibility, as they see it, between science and religion, and what often turns into a kind of enmity and contempt for religion, wanting to root it out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get your thoughts on that.
Well, science, I love science, and science is a great and honorable way of trying to understand and know reality. But scientism is when science goes way beyond what it can ever know and makes judgments that it has no evidence for and makes even a dogmatic fundamentalism that is just as fierce, just as ignorant as the dogmatic fundamentalism that maybe brings down buildings. If scientists, the so-called militant atheists, really do not understand much about what religion really is, and they're profoundly ignorant about the nature of religion, because once you take all the horrific things that have been done by through misinterpretations of religion, through egoistic religationship to religious ideas.
Or in the name of religion.
Huh?
Or in the name of religion.
In the name of religion, yeah. Which maybe also often, at least in modern times, conceals a political ambitiousness of some kind or personal egoism. And if that's what you call religion, okay, fine. Nobody likes that. Nobody approves of that. Nobody respects that kind of religion outside of those who perpetrate it. But just look at it under the surface. Look at religious teachings. Look at what religion has brought to the world in the most positive possible sense. It becomes an entirely different thing. So if I were to go somewhere, write a book, talk about science, knowing as little about science as as Dawkins knows about religion, I would be laughed off the stage. It's ridiculous.
Yesterday, I had occasion to be in conversation at the JCC in San Francisco with the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, Jonathan Sacks, and he said, there's bad religion, there's bad science, too. I mean, he mm-hmm. mentioned, you know, the kind of science that was done under the rubric of science by the Nazis or viral infections and so forth. But he also had a kind of square off with Dawkins because he said, Dawkins kept talking about the Old Testament God, and he said, well, that's anti-Semitic. That's what you hear, you know, from Christians categorizing. I've known Richard for years. I don't think he's an anti-Semite. But
no, yeah.
But he does have a contempt for religion. And if you talk about the good things, as you're suggesting that religion does, or the bad things that have been done in the name of science, there's a kind of black and white there that doesn't necessarily entertain.
But science, in its honorable sense, science is not in opposition, in violent opposition to religion in its best sense. But it represents a different kind of knowing. And that kind of knowing knows very well things that maybe the religious doesn't touch. But it knows, it can perceive things, it can understand nature in its mechanical and awesome quantitative structure. But what it shows us is a world full of purpose, full of that there's a center somewhere, that there's a purpose somewhere, not in a superficial sense, but that there's an intelligence, an order, a sensibility in nature, a beauty, a sublime nature to it. You need your heart for that. That's what wonder brings you. Wonder brings you a sense of meaning. There is meaning. There is beauty. There is order. And I'm part of that. And I'm so small. And yet, because I can feel it in myself, I must be, in some sense, one with it.
You can have that feeling, though, without religion, without faith. You can have it in awe of nature.
Of course.
Of course. And I think that has to be emphasized.
Of course.
This rabbi also said that science takes things apart. Religion puts them together. And he talked about the two hemispheres of the brain being like, so he sees a partnership between science and religion. Many would, of course, balk at that and find it unacceptable,
but
I'll just put it out there.
It does point to it may not be the way to it, but it does point to a great and ancient teaching that a human being is uniquely of two natures, one pointed toward the outer world and another pointed uniquely toward the inner world. And those two exist in us, and they do move in a different direction. One toward the inner world, which is one with the inner world of the universe, and one toward the outer world, also the outer world of the universe. And we are called to be in between those two and struggle between those two.
Let's bring some more of our callers. George, join us. You're on.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It sounds to me like the two spheres that he's talking about are inherently incompatible. It sounds to me like what happened was the atheist did his rational thing and then realized what the world looked like without this underlying sense of purpose, as Mr. Needleman puts it, and didn't like it, didn't like what he saw, and so decided to put this patina of purpose, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, in order to make it more palatable. I can understand why one would want to do that, but that doesn't help me understand reality the way it is. There's a difference between what's normative versus positive, prescriptive versus descriptive. It seems to me that if you're talking about the descriptive realm, you've got to stick to science. And for prescriptive reasons, you might say what you're saying to basically give some sort of meaning and purpose to life, which I understand, but I don't think that that's what reality is.
It depends who the knower is, but what we don't look at very carefully is the instrument by which we come to the conclusion that you're reaching, which is very honorable in its way, because who or what is the knower? If we are only knowing the universe or reality by one part of the mind that itself is structurally incapable of seeing value and purpose, if that's all we're using, that part of the mind, naturally we come to the conclusion that the real world is without purpose. But if we use the whole mind, which includes the heart and the body and all working together in some extraordinary way, in other words, if we look at the reality with another state of consciousness, order and purpose and meaning scream out us from every place and whisper to us from every place, including the violence and the things we don't understand in human nature. That brings us a whole question that we have to start with. Why are human beings vile?
That can lead you also to, well, chaos, skepticism, to all kinds of things other than order. I mean, you're suggesting that order is maybe a natural path.
Yeah.
But it may not be.
No, it may
not
be.
For many, it is not.
No, it may not be. But on the other hand, in order to get to the part of ourselves that can know the answer to these great unanswerable questions, we probably need to have a knowledge to guide us that doesn't come from our everyday state of consciousness.
Let me thank you, George, for your call and go right to some more of your calls. We'll go next to Janice. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, hi. You're on the air.
I've been listening very closely to what's being said, but I find it really interesting because indigenous cultures have an intrinsic understanding of the connectedness to the earth, yet Western civilization and Western man has done everything in his power to destroy those peoples and, in essence, going back to first Genesis, to subdue the earth. And in that context, he has looked at a forest, for instance, and saw it only in the context of how many bird feet it is. As far as the question of that one of the other callers raises, what is our relationship with nature? This is really interesting because your author is pretty much completely in line with what was written by Vine Deloria, a Native American author, in his book, God is Red, which came out 30 years ago.
Oh, yes.
So I think it's pretty much impossible for most westernized people to let go of that duality between man and nature, between science and religion. I would love to have your author tell me that that's not the case.
I think, in essence, what she says conforms to what you pretty much have brought to our attention. We go back to indigenous people and all kinds of ancient people, and they see that kind of unity. It's very difficult here in the West to recapture that.
It is difficult to recapture that, but it's really a great task now. And unless we do recapture it, who knows what will happen to us or our Earth. It has to be recaptured while honoring science for what it can bring, which is astounding, still that it doesn't provide us the answer to the questions of the heart that are absolutely essential to our life on Earth.
Well, you've read my book. What about the answer being there may not be an answer?
There may not be an answer, but we how to look at that possibility honestly with all of ourselves. That might be our... There may not be an answer if we ask it with the part of ourselves that cannot possibly hear the answer. Well, are we so sure we're looking at it with all of the capacities we have for understanding, all of our epistemological powers, not just logical mind, sense perception, which is what we have highly developed, but also the sense of wonder, which what we experience as the sense of wonder may be only the seed of a capacity of consciousness that brings a whole new kind of knowledge to us.
Listener from Canada asks, what is the relationship between Gurdjieff's ideas and the living Earth, and what is the source of Gurdjieff's ideas, in Professor Nadelman's opinion?
Well, his...
We're talking about Georges Gurdjieff, who was an important figure in spiritual mysticism, had a place in Fontainebleau. I just want to give a little information here for people who may not know, and Professor Nadelman's been in Gurdjieff work for many years, which a lot of it physical, a lot of it having to do with dance and the body and higher consciousness.
It has to do with, that's right, it has to do with self-knowledge and coming in touch with all these things that I've been speaking about, the knowledge that is sourced in the body and the power of perception and consciousness that comes from the higher feelings and the mind all working together.
And the Gurdjieff movement, we should mention, was also played a major role in the lives of many artists, Hart Crane, Catherine Mansfield, Jean Toomer. All went to Fontainebleau.
Yes, and some contemporary people as well. So he was really a remarkable teacher and brought a kind of knowledge that seems to have come to him from another kind of inner work that he discovered when he was even quite young. And his view of the Earth is exactly what I'm trying to open up in this book, that the Earth is a living being, and we are part of this entire cosmic scheme that requires of us that we become fully human, not that we become fully mechanical beings. And he offered a way, a method, which is worth considering by people. It is extraordinarily interesting.
I must tell you, I read Gurdjieff many years ago, and you write with much more poetic and better prose style. Monica shares on her Facebook page, I was raised an atheist, and as a child, I always found a strong comfort and connection to the land, the trees, the ocean, and the animals. We lived in the country and became acutely aware of the circle of life and the systems surrounding us. I knew there was something bigger than humanity, and I always found comfort in that. When I came to faith 5 years ago, Christian, yes, please don't flame me, I realized that this was God. God created this beautiful, amazing planet and all of the systems and bodies within it and beyond. This is a profound realization for me, and I remember the exact moment when it happened. Another listener writes, science can be politically manipulated, no doubt, but it's far easier to manipulate religion. So one side, fed propaganda, holds tight to dogma, while others grow disgusted and give up on religion altogether. Both end up degrading the religious aspects of religion.
Well, the religion that a lot of us are acquainted with nowadays, it may not be the religion that one has to take seriously. It's all serious because anything that provokes enormous waves of energy and violence and all the rest of it has to be taken seriously. But how to understand it? How to understand that that religious teachings have existed as far back as we know. I doubt if there's been any significant civilization that hasn't been rooted in something we could call religion or religious or spiritual. So it must not just correspond to some inner weakness of all human beings, but some inner possibility of all human beings. That it gets distorted and turns it to its opposite. This is one of the whole problems of that all the great religious teachers and spiritual masters and great spiritual philosophers have had to face. Why are we not what we are meant to be?
Humans live and die from ideas. Huh?
That's exactly right. And there are ideas that are awakening, and there are ideas that are toxic, and how to distinguish that.
Well, you distinguish between vertical and horizontal ideas. Can we talk about that for a moment? Because you say that young people particularly are looking for vertical ideas as opposed to the horizontal distractions of our culture.
Absolutely. They're looking to, when I taught about Emerson, for example, years and years ago, I first taught a course in Earth, was worried that my students at Snape would not relate to it because he was a subtle thinker and his language is so extraordinary. And they were absolutely thrilled when they read Emerson. And I asked them why, and they said, and they all agreed, it brought us hope. Now, what kind of hope is brought by these vertical ideas about meaning and purpose and the oversoul in all of us? The hope is that they experience hope when they come in touch with a part of themselves that they didn't know about, that hadn't been honored, that suddenly wakes up and says, I'm here. And this is the part that wishes to relate vertically to other possibilities above us rather than on the same level as us.
So you use oversoul. That's Emerson's word.
Exactly. That's
so it's transcendent.
It's transcendent, yes.
A listener tweets us, in the old days, religion was what couldn't be explained by science. Now science is what hasn't been explained away by religion.
That's good.
Another listener says, actually, I did a whole program at the Herbst Theater with two Nobel Prize-winning physicists, Sal Perlmutter and George Smoot, about the Mayan calendar. And this listener was built around that, at least. We were talking about much more than that. But since there are many circulating predictions regarding the worldwide and potentially cataclysmic effects of the so-called end of the Mayan calendar on December 21st, 2012, many theories regarding an awakening or jump in consciousness at that time. Any thoughts on this matter? The listener wants to know.
Well, on the part that this is the end of the world, I've lived in San Francisco for 50 years, and every year there's been at least two very big predictions that it was all over. And
I was assured by two Nobel physicists that it's not going to happen.
Oh, well, even so, it still may not happen.
Not on that date, at any rate. Yeah. But how seriously should we take the notion that, the Mayans were a pretty advanced civilization. They were very smart about so many things.
They were.
Maybe some jump or leap in consciousness might be coming?
Jump in the state of consciousness. It may be that that's become what's become possible for us to work in that direction. But I don't believe that human consciousness just grows automatically. I think we're brought to a certain point, and then it's up to us to try to work for it.
What was that event where everybody tried to reach a stronger harmony a number of years ago? You remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, but there were so many like that. I don't know what. I mean, I think that's fantasy. I think fantasy. I think what I've learned and studied is that we can develop something in us that is truly higher consciousness, but it takes work and understanding and a community is devoted to it. It just doesn't happen automatically.
Let me go to more of our callers, and we go to Brian and Arinda. Brian, welcome. You're on.
Thank you. Yeah, luckily in a graduate program that blend some psychology and theology, actually, at least the class I'm teaching. And so this is all really refreshing to hear. Just a comment and a question. The comment was I'm actually encouraged, apart from what some people might think, that even within Orthodox Christianity, and I'm thinking there's almost a latent kind of a nature of spirituality going back maybe as far as St. Francis and on to Celtic Christianity and then later even maybe surprisingly to Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan of Puritans. And so that kind of reflecting back on an earlier caller who had kind of wondered if this is all the domain of Eastern or Native American kind of religion. So it's just a comment. I wonder if you're Dr.
Well, you see beauty of nature in sinners in the hands of an angry God, and all, that's Jonathan Edwards.
That's the sermon we all read in high school, but he's got so much on actually finding God in nature. It's journal entries around hikes he took in New England, and it's this whole extra body in Edwards. Edwards still has so much that hasn't been published of his sermon. That's a fascinating kind of blooming area that has more nature than you'd ever expect. But and actually, the question I had is how do you get away with? I'm asking for some advice here. As an academic, how do you get away with speaking the way Dr. Needleman does in academic settings where the scientific method still sort of reigns supreme and every belief that can't be validated by the scientific method is sort of dismissed as mysticism? I'm really wondering.
No, the scientific method, there's a definite kind of deference to secularism in the academy.
Yes, very much so. But I think cutting deeper into that question is that if in a university, someone like me who has this kind of interest in deep respect for the spiritual dimension, but also a lot of respect for the academic process and the capacity of thinking intelligent, logically with honorable research and original thought, we have to honor both sides in philosophy. People come to philosophy classes and probably to literature classes too often enough because they have an inner hunger as well as an outer interest and need to become academically professional. So my work has always been to honor both sides as much as possible and present ideas with young people especially are starving for because they're confronted with so many I call toxic ideas, horizontal dogmatism, that everything fine in human nature is really basically some primitive animalistic urge or killing the tigers or attracting the mates. There are things in human nature that are far beyond anything that can be explained by reduction to neo-Darwinian thought. And students are starving for that kind of thing without condemning anything academic at all. So how to support their academic work and also realize in philosophy especially, they're looking for a way to deepen the questions of the heart.
Brian, thank you for your call. Good to hear from you this morning. Let me hear from another caller, and that's Martin. Good morning.
Hello. Dr. Needleman, I've followed you for many years. I've been into the Gurdjieff philosophy, and when I just heard about your experience of the earthquake as an external shock that put you in a state of awe, that made you more conscious of the totality of the whole, that to me is extremely interesting. And way beyond the conversation of whether religion and science are battling or whatever, is that the fact of this external third force, this shock that put you into awe, that allowed you to perceive the world in a whole new way, that, to me, is the interesting thing of this conversation.
So thank you. I think that is a very interesting thing for all of human life when we have those moments. And the culture we live in does not know how to value those moments as being like a voice, a call from another level in ourselves that says, here I am, let me into your life more.
And I thank you for the call, and we'll get another caller on. Howard, that's you. Hi.
Hi, thank you. What you have said, Mr. Needleman, really resonates with me. And I've done lots of reading, and one of the people I love to read is Plotinus, who says that as you do, that essentially the kingdom of heaven is within. And if you go inside, that you'll find that we have a kind of soul that is coextensive, if you will, if a soul can be extended, with the soul of the world, with the being of the world. And I think that that science actually supports that the conclusions of science, not necessarily the methods, but the conclusions of science really support that, because it says we're all one system, that we, just as the sun burns molecules, so do we to exist. And consequently, all our sentiments and our scenarios and our internal life, life of mind, is a creation of the same system, and thus there really is no separation in that sense. So, can you comment on that, please?
Yes, that's true. I think if you look at what actually science is discovering, it all is so awesome and so interrelated, so organic. just seems it seems to be the only thing you can say about it is obviously there is an overall system, you call it, an overall intelligence, an overall energy, an overall moving life process in it that we need to understand in ourselves as well as in nature. There's also something called consciousness, which that has to be brought into the picture, brought into the subject without attempting to reduce consciousness to something that is not conscious.
Well, the book makes us more conscious of the Earth and our relationship to it. Again, the book is called An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth by Jacob Needleman. Always good to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us. He'll be actually appearing at West Portal Bookstore at 7 o'clock this Thursday. I wanted to make sure that listeners heard about that. And also remind you that you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. We welcome you doing that. And, of course, always communicate to us about anything you hear on Forum by going to our Facebook page or by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And we'll be, if all goes according to plan, back with you on the morrow. I want to give credit to all of those who are behind the scenes here, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Again, I thank you for being with us. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, stay tuned. Stay with the station. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.